Okay, my name is Nick Corbishley. I'm a British citizen who's been living in Barcelona for the last 20, more or less 22 years almost. And I'm a journalist who covers finance, politics, and economic issues, should I say, mainly in Europe and Latin America. And I wrote a book in the final 3 or 4 months of 2021 called Scanned, Why Vaccine Passports and Digital ID Will Mean the End of Privacy and Personal Freedom for an American publisher called Chelsea Green. And I am writing a couple of articles a week for an economics website in the United States called Naked Capitalism.
Okay, on finance journalism, I'd be interested to hear what you make of the changes that we've seen over the last decade or so, with the move towards less and less cash, more and more electronic money. What does this actually mean for us? Because I'm quite aware that this actually makes it much easier for some people. I mean, I'm not quite even sure who to keep a close eye on everything we're doing financially.
Yeah, I mean that's a trend that's been going for, some would argue, decades, but I mean, like, certainly the last 10 years has seen an intensification in the war against cash. We've seen lots of jurisdictions taking more and more draconian steps to limit how much people can pay for things in cash. So I think that in the European Union, it's now down to 1,000 euros. I think that's the case. Although, I mean, like, there are countries like Germany and Austria where they're still sticking to kind of like much higher cash limits. It's I mean, like, the COVID pandemic has had an important impact on the use of cash. In the first month of the pandemic, the World Health Organization came out suggesting that cash could be an important vector for the virus, and this was pounced on by mainstream media. It was pounced on kind of like, well, you could say the many enemies of cash, companies like Visa, MasterCard, many of the tech companies that have very openly said on many occasions that they want to kill off cash, and it was magnified by them and reported, widely in the mainstream media. So I think that that had a very important impact on the use of cash just about everywhere. So I mean, like, in the UK, the UK was already long down the path towards kind of cashless economy. And I speak to people in the UK who tell me they haven't used cash since the first month of the pandemic.
Well,
They
look,
just
I
want.
mean, we're on, I suppose people like you and I are in danger of being labelled Luddites. I mean, surely this is just a new technology which has surpassed cash. It's a lot easier than cash. Basically, it's a kind of chip on your card which can get you onto a bus, it can buy you a new computer. Cash is basically history. Why, I suppose my question is, why does it matter?
Well, it matters because cash provides certain benefits that digital money or digital payments systems don't provide. So, I mean, like, cash offers the possibility of anonymity. It offers the possibility of privacy, and these are two things that are becoming, are more and more valuable as we are surveilled more and more in our day-to-day activities and day-to-day transactions. So I mean, that is one very important benefit of cash. Another important benefit of cash is that it's universally available to everybody. So it has this incredible inclusiveness, and this is something that even central banks have kind of like acknowledged in recent years, that is very, very valuable. So if you are talking about an economy, say, for example, like Mexico, my country-in-law, my wife is from Mexico. We visit every year or two. And, you know, in Mexico, I think something like 50% of the country is unbanked. So if you move to kind of like a completely digital economy, that means 50% of the people cannot participate in the economy. It would be insane to do that in a country like Mexico. But it's also about like the elderly. The elderly struggle to navigate the, you know, digital money payment systems. So you have serious, you know, if you're in your 80s and you're being told that you can't get cash from your branch, you have to go to the ATM, and they've just changed the ATM. So you've got to try and struggle and find your way through this new machine. If you don't have a younger, you know, a son or a daughter or grandson or granddaughter that to help you, then you're essentially lost. And this is something that's happening to many elderly people in huge numbers of countries. As branches disappear, as ATMs are withdrawn, or cash points are withdrawn. And I think that all those things are vitally important. There's also the resilience of cash. So we've seen on a number of occasions where you have a natural disaster, such as, for example, Puerto Rico in 2017. It had an earthquake, although it could be a hurricane, but it was an absolute disaster, and it laid waste to the island. And for a period of weeks, there was no electricity. And if you did not have cash on you, you couldn't transact. And these are all very essential elements. I mean, like, we have seen in the last year and a half, a massive rise in the number of bank outages, like outages of IT systems of banks. We saw an example of this in Canada recently when the government passed its Emergency Powers Act. The bank systems go down, and suddenly you cannot transact. You cannot make a transfer. You cannot buy anything. And this is happening in so many different places. The UK is, every week in the UK, one of the major banks will suffer a brief outage. And that means that people can suddenly, if they've grown dependent on digital money, they suddenly cannot use it for a few hours. Now, if you imagine a situation where that becomes, instead of a few hours, a few days or a few weeks, like in Puerto Rico, then you have an example of just how the vulnerabilities of a purely digital system.
Yeah, well, that's amazing, isn't it? I mean, I've also seen electronically, you can be, I mean, this is quite recently, actually, getting onto a bus, and some guy in front of me, his phone just ran out of power just before he was about to buy his bus ticket.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if this is a dream technology, but the thing is that it is fatally flawed somehow.
What
happened was, in that case, is the bus driver just waved him on, said, "Oh, look, don't worry about it," you know. But if it's in other circumstances, say, for example, you know, you're sitting in a car, you're trying to pay for a toll, crossing a bridge or something, and all of a sudden if something goes wrong, it doesn't work or whatever. Mm-hmm. This is putting us into a bit of what are the untold consequences of this? You've just talked about possible power outages there, but there must be more.
Yeah, I mean, there was an example recently there've been a number of examples recently in the UK with the, I think it was Heathrow Airport, has had serious problems with the electronic border system, electronic border pass system. It periodically goes down. And I think there was one occasion, not that long ago, where the systems went down at numerous airports across the UK. And suddenly they had to go back to the old school way of doing things. The problem was is that they were understaffed. And this caused hours and hours of queues. So it was an example of just like you said, this kind of like the vulnerabilities, the fragility. You mentioned this guy on the bus. I mean, I have a friend who's gone completely digital, and we would go out for a bite to eat, and his mobile, you know, the battery will run out, and he'll suddenly say, "Oh Jesus, could somebody give me 20 euros or 30 euros in cash? I'll pay you back tomorrow." And it's like this is the fragility of a purely digital system. It is very utopic or utopian, but it has serious weaknesses. Other untold consequences. I mean, like, I think that we risk excluding enormous numbers of people from the, should we say, the official economy. Because if you are not, you know, if we are moving towards kind of like a digital identity, central bank digital currency system, then if you are not doing everything you're supposed to be doing, then you could suddenly find yourself being separated from your money. And this is something we saw happen very recently in Canada, when the people who participated in the Freedom Convoy, or even just people who had donated, it could have been as little as $50 to that protest, suddenly found that the bank had the power to seize their money, to freeze their accounts. And it is, I think that this is one of the scariest elements, is like how we will be giving enormous new powers to, whether it's central banks or whether it's to governments, over our finances, over our ability to spend, over our ability to save, over our ability to earn money. So I think that is possibly the most important potential consequence of all this.
Well, look, another aspect that you go into in quite a great deal of depth is this whole idea of the vaccine passports and the digital IDs. What is the link between digital money and these digital passports or digital ID?
Okay, well, I mean, like, when we talk about digital money, it's very important to be clear what we mean. So, I mean, like, we use digital money all the time. When we pay with a credit card, when we pay with a debit card, when we pay with our mobile phones. So, I mean, like, these are forms of digital money. What we should be clear about is that in the not too distant future, there are almost 90 central banks on the planet that are very interested in creating central bank digital currencies. And this is a whole different kettle of fish. And most people are not even aware that this is happening. A central bank digital currency will revolutionize the way money works. It will provide much greater power to the central banks to control the money supply. It will allow them to track and trace everything we spend money on, everywhere we receive money from. And they've said this in very, very clear language. So you've got the president of the Bank of International Settlements, Agustin Carstens. The Bank of International Settlements is the central bank of central banks. And he said, you know, if you've got somebody spending $1,000 or $1,000, then it's impossible to know what they're spending their money. It's impossible to know where that money's going. But when we have central bank digital currencies, we have virtually total control over that whole, you know, the whole direction of the money and how that works. I paraphrase there. But I mean, like, this degree of control is essential. And at the same time, we have recently we had a report coming out of the Financial Times, which featured a Goldman Sachs, senior Goldman Sachs banker. He was saying that there's the only way you could possibly have a central bank digital currency is if you have a digital identity, if everybody has a digital identity. So these two things go hand in hand. Without the digital identity, there cannot be central bank digital currencies. So it's about before you are able to put into effect this completely electronic system of money controlled by central banks, everybody needs to have their own digital identity. And this opens up huge new avenues for government to track and trace us, but also to control our actions. So like we saw in Canada, it will be possible for central banks to stop certain people from being able to transact. It will be much easier for them to do so. they would not need to pass new laws or anything like that. And there's also been talk in the Bank of England about programmable digital money or programmable central bank digital currency. This means that the central bank will be able to decide what people can spend their money on. So, I mean, it completely transforms the way money functions. There's also the possibility that we will start receiving universal basic income, which is becoming, you know, we're seeing more and more countries going down this route. Canada is very close to launching its own UBI. I think that Ireland is talking about doing that. So you've got more and more countries that are talking about launching universal basic income, and they would be doing this probably on a time limited basis. So you will receive essentially free money, but it will be probably replacing most welfare based money. And that money will be in your account for a very brief period of time, and you will have to spend it. So I think that what a lot of people don't realize is one of the beautiful things about cash is that you can actually have it in your hands. It can belong to you. You can take it out of your bank if you want. You can have it under your bed. You can have your own money. But I mean, like in a purely digital money system, your money is always residing in one account or another, one digital account or another, or it is moving between accounts. You will never, ever be able to access it. If there is a bank run, if there is a bail-in, what we call a bail-in, which is when a bank goes under, and in order to recapitalize it, they use money belonging to the creditors of that bank, including bondholders and shareholders, but also depositors. You may suddenly find that part of your savings have been used to recapitalize that bank. And you will not be able to do anything about it. And this is the thing. It really is divorcing you from control over your money. So it is a revolutionary change. And yet there is no discussion. There's no conversation. There's no national debate, as far as I'm aware, in any country about what these things genuinely entail.
Well, isn't it interesting the way that this is just kind of happening? You know, the whole idea of the chip and PIN was just decided and it happened. And the idea that you had to sign a signature to use a debit card and a credit card just disappeared. There was certainly was no public debate about that. Then there's the idea that no longer do you use a PIN. You just wave your credit card and on a contactless reader and the money goes in the right direction, or hopefully in the right direction. So this is something which is almost, it's just, you're right, it's just happening to us. One of the things you just said there about this programmable central bank digital currency, which is entirely new to me, reminds me a little bit of the Chinese social credit system. The idea that someone somewhere could remotely say, well, you are allowed to spend your money on this, but someone else is, but someone else isn't.
I mean, I think that that is something that I do go into in some detail in my book. This ability to nudge people into what are considered by whether it's governments or central banks or whomever to be the right sorts of behaviors, the right sorts of actions, and away from the wrong sorts of behaviors and the wrong sorts of actions. It's a creeping authoritarianism. It's a lot more subtle and a lot more discreet than the sort of authoritarianisms of the past, where we have kind of like a mustachioed figurehead that is on the walls of, whose picture is on the walls of kind of like every classroom or every public building. I mean, like, this is something a lot more discreet, but there's something almost more pernicious about it because it's so subtle, and I think this is why there's so little awareness of this, because people just, they don't have the time to investigate it. They don't have the time. And it's clearly not being presented to them. You're not seeing front cover articles about the risks of central bank digital currency in any newspaper.
It's all very well discussing and, you know, railing against this, but what do we do?
That's the hard question. I mean, like, I think that number one, we try to inform everyone we know as much as we can. I do think that there has been a shift in the debate. There's been a shift in the narrative over the last 2 or 3 months. I think that people have begun to see that vaccine passports, for example, are not nearly as useful as we were told they were going to be. Especially when you consider that the vaccines themselves have proven to be far less effective at preventing the transmission of this virus as we were originally told. So, I mean, I think there has been a shift of sorts. People are looking for information more, I think, than a few months ago. But the difficult thing is, like, where do you find this information? I mean, it depends what sort of feeds you have on your Twitter account, or what sort of feeds you have on your YouTube account, or what kind of friend you have. But I think the important thing is to try and get the debate out there as much as possible. I think that in Spain, there was an interesting case recently where some elderly people began mobilizing against this kind of, like, the purely digital money focus of the banks here. And they interestingly, they use social media to do that, and it kind of, like, it blossomed into a huge protest movement, and you actually had millions of people taking part, and they got to the stage where they were essentially saying, we are going to stop using debit cards and credit cards on certain days. And at that point, the banks began to sit up and take notice, because they realized, Jesus, people over the age of 60, 65 in Spain are the people that have money. They're the people who have capital, whereas the people who are under the age of 30, 35 are generally earning very, very little money, if they have jobs at all. And they actually took a few steps back and they said, okay, we'll bring back cash services into our branches. We'll set up more ATMs, et cetera, et cetera. So it did show that if you actually organize and you hit them where it hurts, which is on their bottom line, then you can possibly gain certain victories in this. But I think that one thing that certainly gives me a bit of hope is the fact that people are beginning finally to talk about the World Economic Forum, which I think is playing a vital role in this kind of transformation we are being led through. And that gives me a certain amount of hope, because this was an organization that it was only really talked about in the financial newspapers up until, I would say, maybe a year ago. And people are now talking about the amount of influence it has on our governments. I think that is an important step in the right direction.
Well, it is, but isn't it? And also the fact that the World Economic Forum has done what, you know, some have described as a hostile takeover bid at the United Nations, because the UN is strapped for cash. Lots of UN agencies, such as the World Health Organization, always desperate for money. And the World Economic Forum has come along and said, it's OK, guys, we've got plenty of the stuff. why don't we go into partnership together?
Exactly.
So anyway, this week we've had the spring statement from Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor. I think it's almost the first day of spring that this happens. And one of the notable aspects to it is, although we've got this massive rise in the cost of living going on with the fuel prices, etc., and enormous hikes in rent, those on universal credit and on benefits have been told there'll be absolutely nothing for them whatsoever, which makes me wonder whether the idea is to you know, sort of get that part of the population absolutely desperate so that they'll welcome universal basic income with open arms.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a strong possibility that is true. I mean, I think that one of the most important impacts of the pandemic and the lockdowns in particular has been the kind of, like, the decimation of certainly self-employed workers, freelance workers, small businesses. So I mean, like, these are kind of, like, the, we might say, the contingent within the kind of working population that are more independent minded, independently focused. And they've been on the sharp edge of this. And like you say, those people who are already massively dependent before COVID-19 are easy target for kind of unleashing this universal basic income, which, I mean, like, you know, you will see is painted in many corners as a wonderful solution to our problems, when in actual fact, what you're really doing is you're replacing largely functioning welfare systems with something that is essentially a giveaway to everyone, including the richest people. It's a very different way of governing the economy.
One of the fascinating aspects of going away from cash towards these digital currencies, it was talked about in a book from 1965 by a guy called Ned Seidler, S-E-I-D-L-E-R, called The Story of Money, part of the Odyssey Library. And he says in there, the convenience of coins, he's talking about ancient Greece, the convenience of coins proved a boon to trade and minting, and it spread rapidly to Greece from Asia Minor. The foundation of Greece's economy was trade. Coinage was an immensely useful instrument, and for about 1,000 years, the Greek coins would be carried to places as far distant as India and used to trade. Ancient Egypt, on the other hand, he said, had no coinage. It made an extensive use of metal, though, but it had a self-contained society with almost everything it needed within easy reach. Egypt had little need for money. It relied mainly on barter and a highly developed system of credit and bookkeeping. Now, it sounds to me as if we're moving away from the Greek system almost towards an Egyptian system.
Yeah, where everything is debt-based and credit-based. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a good case to be made for that. I mean, I think that one of the reasons why banks love credit cards, debit cards, and mobile money is that yes, it's something that's harder for people to keep track of. It's harder to know how much you're spending. I think the UK has huge numbers of kind of like personal bankruptcy cases because people just can't keep control of their finances. So I mean, there is a beauty to cash. It's another advantage of cash. So like you said, maybe we're going kind of like full circle. Maybe we are moving back towards a largely credit and debt based system and away from this, because ultimately the cash element within the economy is really the only element of the economy which is, to a certain extent, not entirely debt based.
Well, what do you say though, Nick, to those that say, well, actually, this whole idea of cash just simply benefits the black market, benefits organized crime?
I mean, there's that is the classic argument. I mean, like, you have many, many economists making that case. And there's an element of truth to that. So the more informal, the larger the informal economy, the more likely is, you know, it's going to be cash based. The problem with this is if you actually look at where the biggest amounts of money are being laundered or shifted out of the attentions of the what would you say? I'm trying to think. I was going to say the IRS in the UK. You call it the tax office, I think. It's mainly,
yeah,
actually,
HMRC.
There you go. It's been too long. But I mean, I think that it's normally through the banks themselves where most of the money is kept away from, you know, tax, away from tax paying parts of the economy. So I mean, like, it's like HSBC. I mean, HSBC is a wonderful example, which has been caught in numerous tax evasion systems, and whether it's in Switzerland, whether it's in China, wherever it is. I mean, like, this is where the really rich avoid their taxes. And it's the same with corporations not paying taxes in many of, especially the poorer economies where they operate. So I mean, like, it's I think it, that there's an element of truth to the argument that cash plays a role in this, but where the real, you know, the large amounts of money are avoided, it's through the actual, the official banking systems. And I mean, whether, you know, by doing away with cash, you're not going to change that.
So if we do nothing, where's this all going to end up if we all go electronic and onto these the central bank digital currencies, which will tell us where we're allowed to spend on what we're allowed to spend it on? Where is it? Where are we going to be in 20 years time, Nick?
And that's a really interesting question. I mean, 20 years time, I don't know where we're going to be in 20 days time. I mean, especially with what's going on in Ukraine right now. With what's going on in the global economy. I mean, we're going through, I would argue, the most turbulent moment in history since probably the Second World War. So, I mean, like, I would prefer to say where we'll be in 5 years' time or even where we'll be in 5 months' time. But I think if we do go down the road of, like, purely digital, everything digital, we're going to be living in a much more controlled societies where our ability to maybe express ourselves, our ability to move, our ability to transact, our ability to work, our ability to associate with certain people are going to be significantly impacted. I think that one of the great tragedies of our current moment is that we are probably not, we don't value the things that genuinely bring value to our lives. And so, I mean, like, we take for granted things like the freedom of speech, things like freedom of association, freedom of movement. Although, I mean, like, that has probably changed a little bit since the pandemic. I mean, it's, you only start really valuing those things when you actually lose them. And if you go to a genuine dictatorship and you ask people, you know, what it's like not to be able to say what you think about the government, then I think that, you know, you will get a very different answer, although they probably wouldn't tell you because they'd be too afraid. I think that is this, you know, the what awaits us. It's going to be a world of not just much greater control. I think it's going to be a world of far greater inequality. So if the current trends continue, we're going to see the wealthy continue probably to get bailed out, continue to get insulated from the consequences of economic crises, while those in the middle classes, those in the lower classes are going to feel the effects and they're going to get poorer. It's going to be much harder for large people, you know, for large parts of the population to participate in the economy. So we're likely to see more and more people being pushed out to the fringes, into the margins. And I mean, I don't think the benefits for most people are not very clear to me. I mean, apart from basic convenience. But those who really will benefit from that basic convenience will be people who are probably in the kind of like much upper, you know, the higher echelons of society, and especially the super, super wealthy, the, you know, the political, business and financial elite.
Yeah, well, so, hang on, because I mean, I see students, they seem to love this technology. They have hardly got any money to spend. Most of their loans go on their rent. They're quite busy and they don't seem to be able to go out to the pub and that sort of thing very much these days. Not here in Bristol city centre today anyway. I didn't see many. And they seem to be leading this charge. Anyway, look, fascinating chatting with you, Nick Corbishley. The book is called Scanned, Why Vaccine Passports and Digital IDs Will Mean the End of Privacy and Personal Freedom. And it's a pretty bold statement. And I suppose we should really be asking people, every time you're making a transaction, think about how you're doing it, why you're doing it, question whether you're using a card, whether you're using cash, whether you're using a phone, and think about that, because you could be ushering in a world where surveillance becomes the norm. And even some sort of social credit system like the Chinese have got. The price, the book is £13. I'm sure you can get it in other places, maybe even a bit cheaper. But Nick, can you just let listeners know whereabouts they can follow your journalistic work and follow you on social media?
Okay, I'm writing for nakedcapitalism.com twice a week, and I have a blog, a personal blog, which is nickcorbishley.com, and my Twitter handle is Nick Corbishley.
All right, Nick, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
Nice one, Nick.
Okay.
Be good to have your phone. Be good to have a phone number for you at some point. It's just nice to be able to, you know, ask you questions. Like if I need to run something past you, it'd be handy. But anyway.
No, I'm happy to give it you right now if you want.
Okay. Yeah. Hang on. Just get me pen ready. Okay. Go for it.
It's 0034.
Okay.
677.
Yeah.
399.
Yeah. 897. Righto, brilliant. And I'm quite happy to send you my book if you want a copy of it.
Yeah, that'd be lovely.
Well, I mean, the book I did is on the it's pretty dodgy stuff, really. It's about the last few months of the Second World War and deals being done between London and Berlin.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
wow.
It's some stuff because this is while the war was still going on, which I mean, it's quite a bit about what was going on after the war. So would you like that as a real paperback or as a PDF? What would you prefer?
I would love to have it in a paperback version.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely fine. Look, no, it's fine. You might even do a review. You never know, but you don't have to.
No, definitely.
I'm quite happy to send it to you. So what's
sounds
the address?
Very, very interesting.
What's the address to send it to?
The address is Ausius Mark, which is, if you put Calle, C-A-L-L-E.
Yeah.
Ausias, which is A-U-S-I-A-S.
Yeah.
And then Mark, M-A-R-C. That's Kai Ausias Mark. That's, and if you put after that 61,
yeah,
- 63,
yeah,
and Piso, P-I-S-O, 5.3. Piso is like the flat, and that's Barcelona.
Yeah.
08010
Spain. Right. Okay. It might not be straight away, but I'll pop a copy in the post in the next few days.
That would be lovely.
I think really important background for any journalist to understand this because, you know, we were quite clearly doing deals before the war finished, and also making sure that the loot of Europe from the Nazis came here. You know, and we were able to then basically, a lot of the money was laundered. I don't know how much you know about it, but it was laundered through Sullivan and Cromwell, which was the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York. And the Dulles Brothers, I mean, there's a very good book called The Brothers as well. I interviewed a few years ago about the Dulles Brothers. I mean, they were absolutely in it up to their neck, you know. And I know, one of them was Secretary of State. The other one was the head of the CIA, you know, so they basically controlled everything pretty much.
But Kennedy got rid of the CIA, and I can't remember which one it was, but before he was taken out.
Well, that's right. He was talking about it, certainly. And Dulles, I think it was Alan Dulles, was the American ambassador to Switzerland through the war. So he was involved in all sorts of, most of the loot from World War II was in Swiss banks, but the British got the guy out who had control of that at the end of the war. And I've over the last 10 years I've been looking into this deeper and deeper. I've come across, I've met some of the families of people involved in all of this, and Anyway, so
Sounds good. I mean, that sounds great.
There's plenty of information, enough information in there for you to stand it up if you want to, you know. Uh-huh. It's I think important background for most, you know, people to understand. I'm selling a few now, you know. Mm-hmm. But
when did you publish?
Well, I was commissioned to write it by a guy called, I think, is it Charles? I'm not sure his second name. Anyway, at Pen and Sword Books in Barnsley.
Uh-huh.
He got in touch with me by phone and he said, look, your research on this Arnhem battle is really interesting and I want you to do a book, you know. And I sent him a treatment and he said, looks good. And I went up for a meeting with him. And he wrote back to me a week afterwards saying there's no way we're going to publish this because it's too political. So he must have been lent on by somebody, I think, because he was quite enthusiastic. But the book sort of stayed with me and I kind of wrote it anyway. Even, you know, because I'd done most of it, you know, and I just thought, oh, well, I've got some. Anyway, so when it came to the lockdowns, what was it? The Halloween lockdown, I call it, in 2020. Uh-huh. I just thought, sod it, I'm just going to publish. As I'd been trying to get another publisher and getting nowhere. And also, one of the guys I spoke to when I was researching it, who's a very well-known military historian, ex-army himself. Mm-hmm. I was chatting to him as part of all of this. And he lives not far away in Warminster in Wiltshire. And he said to me, he said, look, I'm the expert on this, right? But I never go to the reunions because it's far too political. And it's just bad for my reputation. It's bad for my books, selling my books and stuff, because I get into these discussions about what really happened and that. Jeez. And it ends up backfiring on me. So he stays away from all of the, you know, the sort of reunions for these old battles. And it's obviously not a celebration. It's just a kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so all right, I won't bore you anymore, but I will pop a copy in the
post. No, you're not boring me at all. I mean, it sounds. I mean, I'm, you know, I studied history at university. That is what I love kind of like, especially Second World War and post-war. So, I mean, like there was so much that happened in those years, and yet you don't hear much about it, really.
No.
And you know, all that money, and it's the same with all those, you know, all the people who ended up getting the Nazis that didn't get processed, should we say, in Nuremberg and ended up finding their way into the US or wherever else.
Or NATO.
I mean, Operation Paperclip, I think it was in the US.
Yep, that's right.
And well, I mean, like, these stories are just not told very often.
There are two books that are the main books which I got most of my research from. One is a book called Op JB, which is includes Ian Fleming is involved in this operation at the end of the war to get Hitler's treasurer, effectively. I mean, he was in charge of the Nazi Party too, Martin Bormann, out of Berlin.
Martin Bormann,
the Russians. And then as an American journalist who was working for CBS during the war, Paul Manning, he wrote a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And that charts the activities of Bormann over in South America, setting up all these. He set up 750 companies, and then this money was laundered into those companies. And the other little trick they had is the most important of them were Jews were put in to be chairman. So that it was a sort of camouflage to make sure no one thought this could possibly be Nazi money here because it's run by a Jew. And, you know, so it's just
a little bit like having Zelensky as president of Ukraine.
Oh, yes. Yes. Funny that. Anyway, it looks lovely to hook up and I'll pop that in post in the next few days.
When will you be posting this? Just out of curiosity.
Oh, I don't know. Probably tomorrow, maybe, if not the beginning of next week.
Okay, well, just give me a heads up when it goes live. That'll be on
the interview. It? Yeah, that'll be Friday. Yeah. Friday between 5 and probably more like 7 p.m. our time.
Okay, and that'll be on your own personal blog,
That's
or
that's on our live program, which I do every Friday, and I'll just send you a link to it now.
Okay, fantastic.
All right.
Okay, cheers, Tony.
Cheers, Nick. All the best.
Okay.
Bye.
All right.